Welcome back, everyone, and thank you for joining today as we talk about the Smith & Wesson L-Frame, from the history of why it was developed to some of the features that have been changed since it was first introduced. This is the Mountain Man Dan Show. Everybody, welcome back. I thought today it'd be interesting to do an episode about the Smith & Wesson L-Frame and maybe some of the history that surrounds that revolver. I didn't really know that much about them until I bought my I bought a 586 No Dash last year with a 4-inch barrel, and I didn't really know. I knew they existed, but I didn't really know much about, you know, why it was developed or anything like that. So I thought it might be fun to go ahead and do an episode just about the Smith & Wesson L-Frames, the, you know, the reason it was developed, what changes they made over the K-Frames, and all that kind of stuff, and then some of the, you know, maybe some of the changes or special different models they offered over the years. I am going to apologize in advance. I am recording from work up here, and I actually finally bought a real podcasting microphone. And I think the audio quality of my voice is better, but it's really bad about picking up everything in the background. You know, most people that do podcasts have a little quiet recording studio, and I have a loud generator running right below my window of my room here in camp. So, unfortunately, this microphone was picking that up really bad, and I had to turn some settings down really low to get it to stop picking up that mic, that generator noise. So I'm going to apologize. Hopefully once I get this mic figured out a little more, we'll be able to get some better audio quality in the next episode. But this is the very first episode playing with this new microphone. So there's going to be a little bit of playing around, and I don't think the audio is going to be 100% the best. So I'm going to go ahead and apologize for that, and we're going to go ahead and dive into the Smith & Wesson L-Frames. Okay, so first, let's go ahead and talk about my revolver. Mine is a first-year production, or I think it's a first-year production. It might be a second-year production. I can't remember off the top of my head. But it's a 586, no dash, 4-inch barrel. And when I bought it, it had had a set of Packmeyer grips on it. I didn't get the box or papers or anything like that. I'm not really one of those guys that cares about box or papers with revolvers because I shoot them. So, I bought it from a guy, and he claims to have only fired maybe a half a dozen rounds out of it. I believe him. The thing looked spotless, other than because it had the Packmeyer grips on it. There was a little bit of a stain line around the side, on the side plate, which is normal. Every blue revolver I've ever bought that had rubber grips on it has had a stain line around the edge of the grips, where those rubber grips kind of collect and hold moisture right there. My Ruger Redhawk has it. My Smith & Wesson Model 29-5 has it. This one has it. I've got several other revolvers that all have that mark. This is one of the reasons I like wood grips on revolvers, and that's why I bought a set of aftermarket Target-style wood grips for this Model 586 when I bought it. I think they're Alamon or something like that. I don't remember what brand they were, but they're pretty nice, smooth wood grips. No Target grips. So mine is a no dash, and the no dashes actually had a recall done on them. We'll get into that a little bit more later on when we start talking about the 586 or the early end L frames a little bit more. But mine was never sent back to the factory for that recall, so it doesn't have. So when they were sent back to the factory for a recall, inside the cylinder crane, they're stamped with I think they put an M on the inside of the cylinder crane right there to mark that it's been sent back for that recall, and the recall had been fixed. Mine doesn't have that, and I have had it to have the issue that they sent it, that they issued the recall for. It did do it to me once with that, with a certain brand of factory ammo when I first got it, and we'll get into that when we start talking about that recall later on. I decided not to send the gun back. I think that Smith & Wesson would probably still fix it, even though it's an older gun, because it's a recall. But I don't trust sending an old gun to some of these manufacturers right now. I don't have any personal experience with Smith & Wesson's customer service, but I just tend to not trust customer service departments. And with my hand loads or anything other than that one box of ammo, I have had no issues with this gun having that hanging up. And I've shot it quite a bit. So I don't think I'm going to worry about doing that unless it really becomes a more serious problem. So, yeah, I got the gun. And then, I have a Simply Rugged sourdough pancake holster for it in shark skin that he sent me. And, yeah, I've had the gun for a little over a year now. I don't shoot it as much as my 44 mags, but I've shot it quite a bit. And I've killed some small game with it. But, yeah, I like it pretty well. And when I bought it, when I buy something new or I start learning about something new, I kind of tend to obsess over things. So, of course, I did that with the wanting to know about the no-dash and the recall and that kind of stuff. So I started studying the L-frames, and I thought it was, you know, there's a little bit of history of why it was developed and that kind of stuff. So we're going to go ahead and jump into that. So all the modern Smith & Wesson revolvers, the J-frames, K-frames, N-frames, L-frames, X-frames mostly, all stem back to the Smith & Wesson hand ejector that was introduced in 1896. And that was the first Smith & Wesson swing-out cylinder. And all the modern Smith & Wesson revolvers are kind of based off that same design. They've got a side plate. There's been internal changes. There's been spring changes. There's been changes to the locking mechanisms and the crane and everything else, barrels and everything else. But they're still basically the same basic design. So the first Smith & Wesson hand ejector introduced in 1896 was their little I-frame. Not too many people I know today my age really know about the I-frames. They quit making them back in the 70s. But the I-frames was the little 32 frame. And then in 1899, they introduced the K-frame, followed by the N frame later on. The K frame was, you know, I don't think they call them I frame, K frame, N frame back then. I think that's a newer term, but they called it the military and police. And I have a 1905 M&P second change K frame 38 special. That's a pretty nice gun. And, you know, you compare it to the L-frame, you can see there's quite a few differences, but it's still basically the same design. You can see all the similarities. It's a very similar gun. And mine was built in Smith & Wesson M&P was built in 1910, I believe, is the year on that one. So then after the K-frame came the N-frame. The N-frame was introduced in 1908, and that was introduced for, like, the 44 special. And then, you know, during World War One, they were contracted out as the 1917 government guns and 45 ACP, 45 auto rem, stuff like that. But it was they called it the 44 frame. That's what it was kind of known as for a long time. And then, yeah, the end frames haven't, you know, it's still basically the same again. Same end frame. The 44 hand ejector, what they called it when they first introduced it, and now it's just called an end frame. The Model 29 44 Magnum wouldn't be that much different. I don't remember what the number is for the 44 special. There was a couple years ago they had that special edition 44 special end frames that were for the Clint Smith's. I think that's who it was for, the Thunder Ranch. They call it the 1950 target. It was a modern end frame that was built to look like the old hand ejectors. So they're very similar. And then the last frame size that Smith & Wesson introduced in their revolvers is the X frame, and that came out in 2003. And obviously that's the big one, is the 500 Smith & Wesson, 460 Smith & Wesson. So yeah. So in order to really talk about the L-frame, we need to talk about the 357 Magnum, because the 357 Magnum is what led to the development of the L-frame. So the 357 Magnum was introduced in 1934 in a Model 27 N-frame, and its predecessor was, of course, the 38-44 heavy duties, called a 38 44 because it was a 38 built on a 44 frame. The 38 frame was the K frame, the M&P frame as it was known back then, because Smith & Wesson didn't start adding these numbers until 1957, I think. 1957, I think, is when Smith & Wesson started using model numbers. So before that, it was just frame size. There was the 32 frame hand ejector, the hand ejector, there was the M&P, and then there was the 44 hand ejector frame, which was the end frame. So the early 357s were built on the end frames, and they were actually only built on end frames for a long time until, I believe it was 1957. Yeah, I believe it was model 1957 when Smith & Wesson came out with the model 19, which was their K-frame revolver. And they introduced that, and they offered that in a 357, and a counterpart was the model 66, I believe, which was the K-frame stainless steel revolver. And both the model 19 and I believe the model 66 as well were kind of known for shooting apart. You know, if you shot a steady diet of 357 magnums through them, they just didn't hold up. A lot of guys I know today consider the early and the original Model 19s to be a 38 special that you can shoot 357s in, kind of like a lot of the J frames that are marked 357. Yeah, you can shoot 357 in it, but it's not going to hold up to a steady diet. The 38 special load that'll last forever, but they didn't hold up. Especially the 19s had a reputation for not holding up to a steady diet of full power 357 ammo. So up until the introduction of the Colt Anaconda, I believe in 1955, if you wanted a double action 357, it was the Model 27 or the Highway Patrolman or I think that's what they called the Highway Patrolman. End frame 357. None of the medium framed 357s existed before. I'm sorry, it wasn't the Highway Patrolman. It's the Registered Magnum. 1935, Smith & Wesson introduced the end frame Registered Magnum, and that's what it was known as before it was known as the Model 27. I'm sorry, my brain's a little fuzzy. It's late at night up here. So, anyway, up until 1955-ish, I believe Anaconda, when the Anaconda was introduced. We'll go ahead and just Google that real quick. But anyway, the big end frame was that if you wanted a double action 357, that was it. There was other brands. There was some companies converting the Colt single actions to 357. You could have those. I think like Great Western and places like that were producing single actions. When Ruger introduced their big, the Blackhawk, it was in 357 Magnum. And that was it. The Smith & Wesson, the end frame was the only double action 357. And so the Colt Anaconda, I believe, came out in 1955. And that was the first medium-framed 357. It was, it's a substantially smaller gun than an end-frame. If you ever handled like a Model 29 or anything like that, they're big, heavy guns. And actually, the 357 is going to be even heavier because of it being more metal. It's going to have more metal in the cylinder. It's going to have more metal in the barrel because it's a smaller bore diameter. So they're big, heavy guns. So Colt introduced the Python in 1955, and I can't remember if I was saying Python or Anaconda before, that the Anaconda is their 44 Magnum. The Colt Python, 1955, came out, and Smith & Wesson kind of had to shuffle a little bit because Colt now dominated the market on medium frame, smaller, lighter 357. And the Colt Pythons, from what I understand, I've never shot one, but from what I understand, they kind of had a reputation for being kind of delicate and fragile. So Smith & Wesson scrambled, and in 1957, they introduced the Model 19, and I believe they introduced the Model 66 the same year. Let's look that up real quick. I can't remember for sure. That was the K-frame 357 from Smith & Wesson. They did not introduce the Model 66 until 1972. So I was wrong. So the 19, when it came out, it was the Smith & Wesson K-Frame 357. And they, you know, they're good guns, but like I said, they gained a reputation for being kind of delicate. And then, but so those two dominated the market for, you know, another 15 years. So the Python came out in 1955, the Model 19 came out in 1957. 1957 is also the first year that Smith & Wesson started using model numbers. So, I mean, it was in the 70s before any other medium-framed 357s came to the market, and that would have been the Ruger Security 6. When those hit the market, that was an all-new gun, because now we had a 357 that was actually designed to handle 357. Anybody knows Ruger overbuilds all their guns. So the Security 6, Service 6, and Speed 6 all came out, I believe, in 1972. And I've had a Security 6 for a long time. It's a really good gun. I think that's kind of what led to development of the L-frame. You know, Smith & Wesson, by now, theirs had been out. By 1972, theirs had been out for 15 years, the Model 19s. So they've been shot enough. They had gained a reputation for not holding together very well. Or, you know, loosening up. I shouldn't say they didn't blow up or anything. But, you know, they'd loosen up, you know, if you shot a steady diet of 357s through them. And now, Ruger comes out with a full-blooded 357 American steel gun that would handle as many 357s as you wanted to shoot through. I mean, you could shoot 357s through those guns nonstop every day from 1972 when it came out to today, and that gun's probably still perfectly fine. And if you shot one of the early Model 19s that much, it wouldn't hold together. And I believe Smith and Wesson actually dropped the Model 19 at some point. They reintroduced it here a couple years ago, and they started offering it again after they changed so like the metallurgy and that kind of stuff. But anyways, we're talking about the Ruger right now. Anyways, and the Ruger is a good gun, and I believe that's what really pushed Smith & Wesson to develop the L-frame. So, I just Googled here real quick. Yeah, so Smith & Wesson dropped the Model 19 in 1999. So, I mean, they still produced it for 20 years after they came out with the L-frame. So, that's actually longer than I thought they did. And then they reintroduced it in 2018, and it's been made from 2018 till now. And obviously the new ones are going to have the Hillary hole and all that kind of stuff. So there we have it. The Model 19 came out in 1957, and it was produced all the way up until 1999. 1980 is when Smith & Wesson started producing the L-frames, and they introduced it in the 586 and the 686. So the 586 is a blued model. That's what I have. And then the 686 is the stainless model. So we're going to go ahead and get into the L-frames now. Okay, so 1980 comes along and Smith & Wesson introduces the L-frame 586. And in 1981, they introduced the 686, the stainless version. So I forget what model. I think they had they called it the 581 and the 681 model were the same as the 586, 686, except for they had standard fixed sights instead of the adjustable sights. You know, and these were Smith & Wesson developed the L-frame 586, 686 to, you know, be kind of a police for the police forces and that kind of stuff. So it made sense to have a fixed sight version that was more cost effective for them to produce and sell in large quantities. So, yeah, so 1980 comes around, the 586 comes out, and this is the first L-frame. And right away, if we look at the guns up close, like they look like a K-frame, but I forget what all the changes are off the top of my head. I know the cylinder is bigger around, so there's more meat in the cylinder. I think they moved the cylinder latch in the bottom of the frame opening, either to the left or the right. So that way it's not quite centered over the chambers. Gives you a little more meat there. The most obvious difference between the K and the L frames is the 586 was the first gun that Smith & Wesson produced that had a full underlug barrel, and that's what mine has, 4-inch full underlug barrel. They improved the metallurgy on them. There's and I think they did something different with the way the cylinder locks into the frame as well. So yeah, the frame is just a hair heavier than a K frame. It's not an N frame. It still uses if you're buying grips for an L frame, you buy K frame grips. Still very close in size to the L frame. I'm sorry, to the K frame, but without being as big as the N frame. So now Smith & Wesson came out with the 586. A year later, they introduced the 686. And now they had a gun that could compete with the Ruger Security 6, Service 6, and Speed 6. And, you know, they've offered them with different length barrels. I think the first run, first year, they were available with 2.5, 3, 4, 6. And I imagine they made it in their 8 and 3/8 inch also. You know, all the common Smith & Wesson barrel lengths. And I don't remember what I was going to say. Okay, so the 586 No Dash, that's what I have. The 586 and I believe the 686 No Dash were both recalled. So, and the reason for that is, right here, 1987, I knew I had some notes on it. 7 years after the release of the model 686, there are reports of cylinder binding with some types of standard 357 Magnum ammunition for L-frame revolvers manufactured before August of 1987. Smith & Wesson put out a product warning and authorized a no-charge upgrade to make modification to the revolver. All recalled and reworked guns were stamped with an M marking, signifying that they had been recalled and repaired. Thus, it is known as the M modification for all 686, 686-1, 586, 586-1, and 586-2 revolvers. So mine is a no-dash. So what was happening with that is the firing pin and the firing pin bushing were not actually properly fit, and the primers I only had it happen with mine with factory Remington ammunition. It's never done it with anything else. I don't shoot factory ammunition very much. Somebody had given me a couple boxes, so for me it's not a big deal. It's never done it with my hand loads, and I've shot the gun quite a bit. But what was happening was when the gun is shot, the primer can kind of flow back into that oversized firing pin recess bushing a little bit, and it will bind the gun up. You won't be able to turn the cylinder. No matter, in mine, it locked it up pretty tight. I had to, you know, tap the cylinder open, kind of shave a little bit of that primer off. So they did issue a recall on that. And like I said, if you send it back to the factory, they'd fix it, stamp it with an M. And that's when the 1987 Smith & Wesson 586-2, they changed hammer nose, bushing, and associated parts. So we'll go ahead and go through the 586. I don't have the 686 marked here, but I imagine they're very, very similar. So the 586 No Dash, 1980 introduction model. Then you had the 586-1, which was introduced in 1986, and they had a radius stud package and a floating hand. 586-2, 1987, is where they issued that recall, changed the hammer nose, bushing, and associated parts. Yeah, and then we see the 586M, 1987, product warning by Smith & Wesson, M overstamped to signify a modification by factory or a warranty station for 586 and 586-1. 586-3, 1988, new yoke retention systems were added, different style. 586-4 in 1993, they changed the rear sight, and they drilled and tapped the frame and changed the extractor and started offering them with factory Hogue rubber grips. 586-5, 1997, they changed the barrel, delete 5 8 3/8 inch barrel, changed to MIM thumb piece. I don't really know what that means. 586-6, 1997, change frame design to eliminate cylinder stop stud. Eliminated serrated tangs. MIM hammer and trigger. Change to an internal lock. And that's what we all know as the Hillary hole. And then 2004, 586-7. Performance center asserted the 38. Super. That's kind of weird. Six shot on fluted cylinder, 4-inch barrel, stainless steel, 250 made, 7-shot with internal lock. And then 586-8 2012 reintroduced to the classic series with an internal lock, 6-shot, 4-inch, and 6-inch barrels. If you look on the Smith & Wesson website right now, they only show the 686 and the Model 69s under the L-frame. They do not show the 586 at all. But I imagine most of those changes were done very similar on both the 586, 686 as far as dash numbers. If you look at the like Model 29s and 629s, because the 629s came out so much later, the dash numbers do not line it up at all. Like a 629-2 and a 29-2 are not even close. But these guns came out within a year of each other. Like when you look at the recall, it says 686, 686-1, and the 586 and 586-1. So I'm guessing that all these changes were very similar across the board and all these revolvers. So, so other calibers that they've chambered the L-frame in, I know for a fact they make it in 44 Magnum. That's the Model 69. And I don't remember all the model numbers off the top of my head, but I believe they've offered it in, I know they offered it in 44 Special, and apparently they offered it in 38 Super. I think they offered it in 41 Magnum. I'm going to look that up real quick. Smith & Wesson L-frame 41 Magnum. And of course, you know, with all the Smith & Wesson Model 57 right here. Smith & Wesson Model 57, 6-round cylinder, 41 Magnum. I believe that the Model 57 is an end frame. Yeah, it is. So that was wrong. My bad. My apologies. The Smith & Wesson L-frame 41 Magnum. Okay, I can't confirm if that one actually exists, but I think it was like a Lou Horton limited edition or something like that. But they did make it in limited runs of 38 and 38 Special. I'm sorry. They did make it in 38 Special. They made it in 357, 44 Special, 44 Magnum, 38 Super, which I just learned about, and I believe 10 millimeter as well. I believe there was a 10 millimeter L-frame. So that's really all I can really touch on the L-frame. I don't know all of the model numbers for those different calibers off the top of my head. The 586, 686, obviously the 686 is still made. It doesn't show the 586 on their website anymore. And then, of course, they still make the Model 69 Combat Masterpiece, or Combat Master, whatever they call it, in a 2.5-inch and a 4-inch barrel option, which is a 5-shot 44 Magnum. And I actually had one of these for a while back when, probably 7 years ago. And I bought it right after I turned 21, so I guess it would have been 7 years ago. And shooting heavy barrel loads out of it, like I shoot my Marlins and my Ruger Redhawks. And it was factory ammo, but they're heavy. And I actually expanded the cylinder chamber so that it wouldn't... It got to where it was on tape to shoot, and it got sold for scrap. So it's not a super heavy-duty 44 Magnum, but I had a Taurus Tracker 2.5-inch, was a very similar size. It's just about an L-frame size, 5-shot, 44 Magnum. And I shot that gun a lot, and I didn't stretch the chambers on it, but I also didn't try pushing heavy. I just shot standard, regular 44 mags in it for the most part. I did shoot some heavy loads in it just to see if it would do it. But I kind of wanted the thing to blow up and see that. And I'm like, oh yeah, the Taurus, it blew up, but it didn't. It was actually a pretty great little gun. I'm surprised they didn't make it in a 41 Magnum. I am pretty sure I saw somewhere like a Lou Horton distributor exclusive 5-shot 41 Magnum on the L-frame, and it would make sense. It'd be a really good candidate for it. But I don't see anything, and I I forgot to look that up and put it in my notes before I started this episode, and I don't want to spend all night Googling while I'm on the air trying to find it. So we'll just have to pretend that that doesn't exist. As far as the 586 goes, I have, like I said, I've said multiple times I have the 586 No Dash. I really like it. I had the, I had Packmire grips. I don't think those are original. I put the wood grips on it. Gun super accurate, very easy to pack. It's not any, it's not really noticeable. I mean, it's heavier, but it's not noticeably heavier than a K-frame. And I've shot quite a bit of game with it, you know, small game rabbits, grouse, and that kind of stuff. And the gun shoots really well. It's probably my favorite 357 that I've ever owned. And I had a Security 6 for a long time I really liked. I don't really like 357 in a single action. I just don't see the point. I like big bores. I don't really like 357. But I do like this. I do like the 586. And if the opportunity presented itself to buy another one, I probably would for a backup. I'll tell you the one I'm really looking for. I'm looking for another 5-inch Model 29-5, like with the full underlug barrel like I have. And I actually found one here a couple weeks ago, and the guy wanted twice what I paid for mine, and most of the bluing was wore off. It was rusty. Nope, not happening. But I do like having, like, the guns I like a lot. I always like, oh, I should have a backup of that gun, so that way if something happens to the first one, I have a backup, but I've never actually done that. So, but anyway, I'm going to go ahead and get this wrapped up. I kind of feel like I didn't really get as many details in here as what I wanted to, but I wanted to get an episode out this week, and I apologize for that, but I hope everybody enjoyed listening to the show. We will try to, I'm going to try to start getting back into doing weekly recordings, and I do apologize for this, for the new mic. I'm still playing with it and trying to get the settings set up, and with the background noise here in camp, I really had to turn some settings down to get it to quit picking that up until I can do something different with it. So I apologize if the audio on this episode is a little funky, but we're just going to keep playing with it, keep trying to make it better. I don't really have a subject picked out for next week yet. I might, kind of in the back of my head, I'm thinking I might just talk about the 44 Magnum because it's my favorite cartridge. I know I've talked about it a bunch on here, but just do a full dedicated 44 Magnum episode. And I might do that next week. That might just go ahead and be what I do next week unless I come up with a better idea between now and then. But anyway, as always, I appreciate everybody taking the time to listen to the show. If you have any suggestions to make the show better, you can be sure to send us a message on Facebook under the Mountain Man Dan Show or my personal page. We're on Instagram, or I'm on Instagram by the name of The Shooter's Apprentice. YouTube by the same name. You feel free to drop any comments on any of those sites, pages, anywhere. If you have ideas on how to make the show better or a subject that you'd like to hear discussed, feel free to get a hold of us and we will go ahead and try to make that happen. In the meantime, this one, I'm going to go ahead and get this one wrapped up. I do appreciate everybody taking the time to listen. And until next time, stay safe and don't shoot yourself in the foot.